Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Tonight, on this recorded edition of Extension 720, we revisit a topic we've dealt with many, many times over the years, as all the world still does, looking back to the years 1939, 1945. Yes, the focus is on World War II. My guest is one of my favorite guests. He's just over from England for a day or two, Sir Max Hastings, who has done superb work as a war historian and also a good deal else that he's written, former editor of the Telegraph in the UK. And the new book, and it's, as people are saying, and as one ordinarily would, it is a masterpiece and really the definitive work on World War II. It is titled Inferno, The World at War, 1939-1945. But an interesting distinction can be made almost immediately. The British title for this same book is All Hell Let Loose. And that says more, in a way, about what you're doing in this book.
Well, what I tried to do in this book, Milt, that I've written lots of books about the big people of the Second World War, about the warlords, the Roosevelts and Churchills and Stalins and, of course, Hitlers and Mussolinis. But this book, I wanted to try and look at the war from the other end for what it meant to the little people, in that if you open this book, you won't find any photographs of generals or politicians or dictators, because this is about what happened to ordinary people in many countries. And although I've tried to give my take on some issues that I haven't addressed in other books about the big things, that what I've really tried to do is to answer the question which lots of people of the generations, our generations, that were fortunate enough not to be there, pa or grandpa, what was the war like? And I've tried to answer that. The answer, of course, it was enormously different according to where you were or what you were. If you were an American paratrooper or a Chinese comfort woman or a Polish Jew or a French collaborator or whatever, the war looked completely different. And I've tried to look at it from all these viewpoints. And the reason I chose the title, All Hell Let Loose in Britain, that when one goes through the archives, in narrative after narrative of battles and ship sinkings and bombing raids, that the writer will end up by saying, and then all hell broke loose. Mm-hmm. And we tend to treat that phrase rather flippantly because it's become a cliche. But in a very important sense, it seems to me, it represents, it reflects what the experience of the war meant to people, because they were plucked out of their ordinary existences and they suddenly find themselves thrust in circumstances which completely transformed all the expectations that they lived with all their ordinary lives, above all the expectation of being protected from violence.
Let me shift you instantly to Germany during the war. And two particular books come to mind. I reviewed both of those books, as it happens, and you treat both of those books in here. The first is the memoirs of Victor Klemperer, and the other is Christopher Browning's book about Ordnungsbataillon 101, an extermination outfit of military police.
Both superb books.
They are.
And they both had an enormous impact on me. That the Browning book, in one of my earlier books, Armageddon, I tried to look at, in one or two chapters, at what the experience of being a victim of the Holocaust, of being a prisoner in the concentration camps, was like. And in every book I do, obviously, one tries to do something different from what you did the last time. So this time I've tried to look at the Holocaust from the Nazi viewpoint. And obviously, Browning's book is absolutely seminal about that.
He studies these ordinary men, that's his very term for them, who were assigned to go and kill Jews.
Well, it is. We're always fascinated because we find it so difficult to understand how, as he said, ordinary men could possibly have been persuaded to do these terrible things. And yet, on the other hand, I'd have thought we probably had enough evidence in our own lifetimes all over the world of what ordinary men and women can be persuaded to do, of the unspeakable things that they can be persuaded to do. that...
Particularly if there's some authority above you who tells you to do it, and in that sense legitimizes
exactly
the
so.
Brutality that you
if
now
you're persuaded, if you're persuaded that you are fulfilling the will of your society and of the apparently legitimate rulers of your society in doing this, then it's okay. And again and again, eyewitness accounts, especially of the early killings that took place outside the concentration camp. You take accounts, eyewitness accounts of the killings in the Baltic states, and a whole host of German eyewitnesses have recorded how when all these Lithuanians and so on would wade in killing with clubs, hundreds and sometimes thousands of perfectly innocent Jewish civilians in front of spectators of the Wehrmacht. Never mind, leave the SS.
The barbarity that was potential in them is actualized just by the Germans undertaking that onslaught against the Jews, so that Poles, Latvians, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, they do all join in.
Yeah.
And, in the murders.
But what again and again the eyewitnesses say is that a lot of German soldiers stood there and watched. They didn't applaud. They didn't say it's good news. But nor did they recoil in revulsion and say, this is terrible. This is unspeakable. This can't happen. Because this was what their society had chosen to do, and this was being authorized by higher authority, that it was okay.
Is this possibly a regularity in all intense, long-lasting wars? Might it be that the men who rolled into Europe under Tamerlane's leadership or under Genghis Khan's leadership, in essence, were capable of the same brutality and did it on orders also?
I agree with you entirely. And one thing we sometimes forget, because the Russians ended up as the allies of the United States and Britain in the war, we tend to forget that the Russians, to me, with the exception of this sole enormous single enormity of the Holocaust, that Stalin's Soviet Union seems to be morally indistinguishable from Hitler's Germany. And one has to remember that when the war started, that Stalin and his people in the Soviet Union had already killed millions of innocent people.
Do you know the work of Rudolf Rummel?
Absolutely.
And you know that in he's the great statistician of genocide in our time through the whole 20th century and beyond. Rummel says that the leading murderer, genocidal and democidal, as he calls it, was Stalin. The next leading murderer was Mao Zedong. The third leading murderer was Hitler. But he accounts for that in that Hitler only had a few years in power.
Well, you can trade punches about among historians about who exactly, but what is perfectly obvious is that Stalin was in exactly the same ballpark. And in 1939, Stalin was already a professional killer. That in this book, statistics can only tell you just so much, but sometimes statistics are very impressive in reminding one of truths. For example, 350,000 people, even in the context of the Second World War, is a lot of people. 350,000 dead people is a lot of people. The Russians, our allies in the Second World War, murdered 350,000 Poles for no other crime than that Stalin considered them inconvenient to his purpose of exercising hegemony over eastern Poland. And this was our allies, who while the war was going on, killed these people.
And before that, in the early 1930s, they murdered, one way or another, by starving them to death or shooting lots of them as well, between 4 to 6 million Ukrainians.
The figures are incredible. And the those people, one of the extraordinary things, obviously, as we know about the Holocaust, is that the evidence is there that the Germans, in an extraordinary degree, kept the records, and they even made the movies, so that we've seen that. We have
efficiency.
We know what the Russians did, but we've actually got less evidence. We've got less eyewitness evidence. We've certainly got no movies. But the fact that in all those murders that the NKVD, Beria's secret police, conducted in 1939-40 of Poles, when Stalin's executioners just hour after hour and day after day massacred countless Polish officers and intellectuals with a single bullet in the head. And these people had made themselves professionals before Reinhard Heydrich and the architects of the Holocaust even got into business.
It is argued by some, as you know, and indeed you treat this in the book, some historians who've looked at World War II very closely and asked what the strategic options were. It is conjectured by some that if they had not done the Holocaust, if they had used the captive Jews for labor, for slave labor, but had not gone into the great killing operation, they might have won the war.
I don't buy that. I think that's over the top. But what is undoubtedly true, one of the issues that interests me most about the war, and I've discussed at length in this book, is that there's almost, we mustn't misuse the word paradox, but there's certainly a contradiction, that the German army, the Wehrmacht, was often brilliant on the battlefield, that it did incredible things, that this was one of the greatest armies the world had ever seen. But everything the Wehrmacht achieved was set at naught by the fantastic incompetence with which the Nazis, and for that matter the Japanese, conducted their war effort. That our armies were sometimes not the equal of the Wehrmacht on the battlefield, but the war machine, that our war machines were far, far better conducted.
We must go on to talk about that, and also about the ordinary people working in those war machines, as we return to Sir Max Hastings, drawing from, but we could hardly do justice to, this long and utterly readable on every page, book, Inferno, The World at War, 1939-1945. That is, by the way, just published in this country by Alfred A. Knopf. We return after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Max Hastings. A few words about the making of this book. Of course, you've done a number of very splendid war histories, and this is probably your 20th or 21st book or thereabouts.
Yeah, this is my ninth book about the Second World War, and I'm sure lots of people will be grateful if it's the last, because they'll feel they read enough from me.
You've done some
this.
Fascinating memoirs and yet other things.
Well, but those are the things, I suppose, in the end, some books you write for fun. I mean, I've written books about hunting and fishing, because I happen to love doing those things, but obviously you do those as a hobby. I mean, they're just fun to do. And I've written three volumes of memoirs about my family and about editing newspapers and about being a war correspondent and so on. But they're the sort of fun parts. I suppose the one thing, as you know so well, that journalism is almost instantly forgettable, but the one thing one hopes might last just a little bit longer is some of the books about the war, because having now been writing about the Second World War for 30-something years, I have been enormously, terribly pleased and touched by what an impact some of the books have made, and I hope they'll last just a little bit longer than my journalism.
This is a book in the French style, so to speak, if one keeps in mind the special approach to history developed by the so-called analyste, which is tell it from the bottom of society, tell it from the life of the people.
Well, I don't think, when I'd finished writing the manuscript of this book, I went through the whole manuscript and cut out all the unit numbers and all the army numbers and so on that I possibly could without making the narrative incoherent. Because I don't think in this 21st century people any longer are much interested in whether the 53rd Division went left or right. The reason that people go on reading books about this period, two or three reasons. One, because the Second World War was the greatest and most terrible experience in human history. Second, because it seems to have been, although huge moral compromises were involved, it was that rare thing, a conflict in which relative good was pitched against absolute evil. And third, there always seem new things to be said about it. So what one tries to do, I've gone lightly on things I've dealt with in other books. You know, I haven't said too much about the Normandy campaign, for example, because I read a whole book about the Normandy campaign 20-something years ago. One's tried to focus on the issues about which you feel that there's more to be said. And what really, this is a book about human experience. This is trying to say, what was it like for all these different people?
And one of the most striking numbers one encounters in this book is the estimates of how many war dead in Russia as compared to the Western Allies.
Well, people are amazed. When a few months ago I ran into a former head of the British Army who said, Max, I hear you've written another book on the Second World War. What can you possibly tell us we don't know already? And I said, all right, let's try a few statistics. What proportion of all the Germans who were killed in the war do you reckon were killed by the Russians and German soldiers? And he said, oh, I don't know, maybe 60%. Well, of course, the true figure is over 90%. Absolutely amazing. What is it, 4.5 million German soldiers killed on the Russian front. And then I said, what about casualties? I said, what proportion of the Allied casualties would you say were British or American? He said, I know, maybe 20% each. And the true figure is 2% each. The Russians took 65% of the casualties. The Chinese, 23%, 15 million dead. The Yugoslavs, a million dead. These nations suffered on a scale. Now, I don't mean this makes our part in the war and our sacrifices in the war negligible. Of course they weren't, to the people involved. But in this 21st century, we ought to be willing and able to look at this from a global perspective, just from the old nationalistic view.
With that count of the high number of Russian dead, if you complement that with the high number of Chinese dead, that reminds you that barbarity wasn't a particular monopoly of the German military. The Japanese were as mad and violent as the worst that the Nazis could manage.
Absolutely. And as far as the Russians go, sometimes people say to me, why did the Red Army on the whole perform better and do more damage to the Wehrmacht than the American and British armies? And I say, well, for a start, if you ran away in the Russian army, you got shot. And another statistic that still fascinates me, the latest Russian statistics show that 300,000 Russian soldiers were shot by their own side for alleged desertion, cowardice, or all the rest of it. That
lots of the returned prisoners were shot by Stalin after the war as well, weren't they?
Well, they all said, I mean, the poor bastards who were taken prisoner and returned from captivity in 1945, half of them were shot and as having betrayed the motherland. The other half was sent off to the Gulag. I mean, this was, in fact, I've said explicitly in this book, what we must never lose sight of with the Red Army. It was a barbarian army which did things that only a barbarian army could have done. I mean, you take the defense of Leningrad. Well, you know, we all complained in the West, or our parents and grandparents did, about the rations and how meat shortages and all the rest of it and so on. So, well, in Leningrad, 800,000 people died mostly of starvation during the siege, and they were reduced to eating each other. That cannibalism became a serious problem. Can you imagine that, let's say, if the Nazis or the Japanese had invaded the United States and you were defending Chicago or you were defending Coventry in Britain, that if people said, well, in order to keep this going, we may have to eat each other. Can you imagine that our societies would have sustained a defense at that cost? I can't.
How did the Japanese match that?
The Japanese...
Or rather, what about Chinese suffering? What was the extent and what was the depth of it?
The Japanese... the savagery of the Japanese, one thing that's very hard for us to understand, is how far for the Japanese, China remained the main front throughout the war. Fortunately for us, the Japanese generals and admirals were, with rare exceptions, incredibly stupid in their approach to the war. I mean, first of all, to start a war against the United States when you're, as a nation, as Japan was, completely dependent on imports coming in by sea, and you take no steps at all for anti-submarine defense to protect your imports from American submarines. You've got to be pretty crazy to do that. But secondly, after the first wave of Japanese conquest in the Pacific, when they'd taken all these islands and so on, most of the Japanese generals wanted to move most of their troops back to China. They had a million men in China. They thought that China was the place that mattered. Well, again, from where we look at it, absolutely bonkers that they must have guessed that the Allies, and in particular the United States, was going to be fighting back pretty quick, and they were going to need every man. But they were fixated with China, and their treatment of the Chinese people, there are these fantastic massacres of Chinese that I'm afraid various people in modern times make excuses about the Japanese, and they say, oh well, this is just the way they did things in their culture and we have to respect that. I can see nothing whatever to respect in that Japanese culture. It's repellent. And of course the other thing that sticks in all our gut is that even after all these years, many modern Japanese are willfully ignorant about what happened. And you take, for example, it's only 4 or 5 years now since the serving head of the Japanese Air Force had to resign his post because he'd written publicly that China's operations in China in the 1937 to 45 period were benevolent. This was a sort of philanthropic gesture. And I met, when I was researching in Japan a year or two ago, very impressive Japanese writer called Kazutoshi Hando. And he was complaining. He was a veteran of the war. I mean, he hadn't fought. He was too young, but he survived the Tokyo firestorm in March 45. And he was saying how shocking it is, how little modern Japanese know. He said he'd spoken 3 or 4 years ago at a Tokyo women's college. And afterwards, he'd invited the students, 50 students, to list the countries which had not fought Japan in modern times. And 11 of them named America among those countries. You know, but this is the way that Japanese society wants it to be, that you've got these new generations.
Well, I must tell you, as a veteran American academic, when I've occasionally done cultural literacy quizzes with my own students, say at the University of Chicago, and if I ask them who did we fight against in World War II, they don't necessarily know that Japan was there. I mean, there's a considerable confusion. They certainly don't know that Italy was against us. It's amazing. It's just not in the curriculum, in the high school curriculum. They come to college where perhaps their lack of historical accuracy is corrected, but I doubt it. We are due for capitalism survived and in that war and still persists despite a number of people sniping at it, and therefore we serve capitalism. And we pause for a newscast for some quick commercials and then directly back to Max Hastings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Max Hastings, drawing from his superb new book, Inferno, The World at War, 1939-1945. This is basically a book about the people who suffered the war and fought the war, but let's come to some of the people who made the war, particularly... Here's something that has always fascinated me as a matter of speculation. It's a counterfactual. We put Hitler, the scene is World War I, and three Frontsoldaten are heading back to the hospital because the guy in the middle is blinded, at least temporarily, in a gas attack. And a shell lands on them, and all three of them are killed. The man in the middle, of course, is Adolf Hitler. If that had happened, it's an ultimate counterfactual. Would World War II have happened?
I don't know. There's a very popular school of modern historians, I'm sure you've met some of them, who argue that history isn't about people, that it's about events and great tides of events. And so there is an argument that, given the scale of German bitterness and alienation and almost hysteria in the 1930s, that it would have found some other vessel other than Hitler. But I'm afraid it seems to me one can't have it both ways. I'm one of those who argues that if Churchill had not existed, that the British would probably have quit in 1940 and would have negotiated. I personally believe that in 1940 it made an enormous difference. In fact, it was absolutely decisive that Churchill was there.
Well, there was a revolt within his cabinet. Halifax was calling for settlement with the Nazis, wasn't he?
Well, most of the British ruling caste were appeasers. At heart, as well as in, and also when the time came that wooing the United States was vital, Churchill was one of the few people in the British upper classes who really liked and deeply respected the United States. Most of the British ruling caste had a cultural contempt for the United States. I mean, memorable that Halifax made that notable remark when he said, "Individually, I met a few Americans who weren't too bad, but in the mass, I've always found them perfectly awful." Well, God almighty, you would think if somebody like that had been... So all I'm coming back to, your point about
later,
Hitler...
During the war, he ends up as their ambassador.
He ends up as... Well, that's because Churchill wanted to get him out of the country, but it was pretty rich to send him here.
Yeah.
But my only point is that if one believes, as I believe, that Churchill was the man who made this decisive difference, the fact that Britain fought on... Hitler was an extraordinary and one won't quite say unique phenomenon, because we've just agreed that morally he was almost inseparable from Stalin. But how can one say? I'm not persuaded he did do something remarkable and almost uniquely terrible in the creation of this. I mean, one thing that Hitler was not unique about, of course, was the anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was much more widespread than people. I'm not making mischief, but it always seems to me important to remember that, of course, nobody in the United States wanted to send Jews to gas chambers, but in Britain and the United States before the Second World War, mm-hmm. in upper crust circles, anti-Semitism was still respectable. That Jews were excluded from American country clubs. And if you go through the memoirs of British statesmen of the period, they said awful things about Jews.
Some years ago, I had on this program Alan Bullock.
Yeah.
Lord Bullock. Mm-hmm. You remember his a great British historian, very much interested in the war.
I remember him well.
His last book was Hitler and Stalin, sort of a Plutarchian treatment of these two almost parallel lives. And you remember he tells a story, whether he in the first chapter or whether in an interview he did with some bright young journalist, he tells a story about his disagreement with Trevor Roper about Hitler's motivation. Trevor Roper argued that Hitler always meant believed all that he said, that he had rectitude in his exterminationist policies. Whereas Bullock says his view was that, no, Hitler was a mountebank, his word, who realized that he had to play the anti-Semitic line to rise in German politics, and then that was the way to bring the Nazis to power. But, says Bullock, after close examination, he came to the view that even Hitler may have started as a mountebank, he came to a sense of rectitude in the extermination program.
But what's awesome, I've just been, when you mentioned Trevor Roper, who of course was the British intelligence officer during the war, and I've just been reading newly published Trevor Roper's wartime journals, in which he wrote in May 1945 how extraordinary it was that now that they'd got in their hands a lot of the leading Nazis who'd survived and they could really see the Nazi leadership for what it was, what an extraordinary gang of murderous clowns, of gangsters. They were. What contemptible people. And one thing, I mean, I'm in the moment in the middle of reviewing for the New York Review of Books a new biography of Hitler and of Reinhard Heydrich. Of Reinhard Heydrich. And one is simply awed the contrast between, fortunately, even if the US Army and the British Army were not always perfect in the war, our war machines were brilliantly run because in our democracies we mobilized our cleverest civilians to run things. And yet, on the other side, fortunately for us, the Japanese and the Germans placed the whole war machine in the hands of these ludicrous people, that if Himmler and Heydrich and so on had not had this power to murder, that the world would have found them ludicrous. I mean, these were unbelievably, to call them fourth rate, I mean, it's almost quite an inadequate word to use, but you know what I mean. These were people unfit to run a cat show, and yet the only thing that they contrived this enormous power because they had the power to kill in unlimited quantities.
But that raises another counterfactual speculation, which many have played with. What if Hitler had somehow had the sense to give up all strategic command to his general staff and had stayed out of the day-by-day planning? Might they have pulled it off?
Oh, well, of course, every former German officer, former Nazi officer I've ever interviewed over the last 30 years always ends up saying, if only the Führer had left it to us, it would all have been different. I don't believe that. I think one of the lessons we've learnt in recent times, my old friend and mentor, Michael Hard, British historian, Michael said, I think absolutely rightly, he was a veteran of World War II as well as a great historian. He said, when we were young, we all neglected economics too much. And he said, now we realise how important economics is. And a number of very important books have been published in the last few years in both Britain and the United States, which have made the point forcefully. Germany was just not economically strong enough to do what Hitler wanted for it. And one of the most telling points, which I mentioned in my book, very important, that everybody dates the turning point of the Second World War from the autumn of the winter of 1942, when the Germans were beaten at Stalingrad. But a year earlier, before Pearl Harbor, that key officials on the economic side, the Third Reich, went to Hitler. They had the nerve to go to Hitler and say, Mein Führer, we have failed to take Moscow before the winter. We cannot win this war. And this is, they realized. Now, that didn't mean they were resigned to losing it. They thought there still might be scope for a successful negotiation for dividing the Allies, whatever you like. But they realized at that stage that Germany simply wasn't strong enough. It didn't have the men and the munitions and the industries to be able to achieve outright military victory. And that's hugely important, and that's all to do. So I think that even if those generals had had their head, they might have done a bit better. But fundamentally, the Allies was so strong relative to Germany economically. I mean, they were, I mean, damn it, as early as the Battle of Britain in 1940, what we now know, and nobody knew then, was even then the British were producing single-seater fighters faster than the Luftwaffe, that Goering had gone into this thing without even trying to make sure that he had a production line that was going to turn out fighters to keep this going. These were not merely, and we talk about mountebanks, that all those people running the Nazi war machine, with the exception of Speer, who was a somewhat more serious figure, but most of them, these were charlatans. These were people who could launch the invasion of Russia without even making sure that they had armored vehicles that wouldn't freese up in the winter and machine guns.
They were charlatans and also thugs and fools, were they?
Oh, that. Well, I say it's, when one looks at Himmler, Heydrich, and the worst of the Nazis today, that I think what is most striking is if you strip them, if you remove from them, if you forget the fact they achieved the power to kill millions of people, what else were they? What else did they? Nothing. Very interesting point. John Lukacs, a historian I greatly admire, he made what seems to me a very important point about Himmler. That he said Himmler spent far more time thinking about the Holocaust than Hitler did, that by, which I think is very interesting and important point, that by 42, although there's no doubt, one certainly doesn't buy the David Irving theory, that Hitler wanted the Jews to disappear, but Hitler was overwhelmingly preoccupied with winning or trying to avoid losing the war. And he was, in terms of the number of hours of the day he spent thinking about killing Jews, it was actually very small. By contrast, Himmler, Heydrich, and so on, they became obsessed with this to the point of fixation. And furthermore, they were actually prepared to seriously damage the economic interests of the Third Reich in order to kill Jews. And this is almost mad. Most people would say the logical thing for the Nazis to have done, say, right, we want to exterminate the Jews, but hadn't we better win the war first? It was a measure of how mad the SS and Heydrich and Himmler were that they could set about this insane program of genocide before the war was won.
Do you know about the encounter, the face-to-face encounter between Heinrich Himmler and Chaim Herzog, the future president of Israel?
No.
Fascinating story, which I shall share with you directly after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And now I make so bold as to tell a great historian an historical anecdote. But I had this from Chaim Herzog. In fact, it is in his memoirs, which he wrote, and he appeared on this program some years ago, of course. He was, during the war, working in British intelligence. He was an Irishman by origin, an Irish Jew. His father had been the Grand Rabbi of Ireland, later was the Grand Rabbi of Israel. And Herzog was in a British intelligence unit up in Hamburg at the end of the war, and all these bedraggled German PWs are coming before them for quick interrogation. And a guy in a corporal's uniform, quite bedraggled and seemingly insignificant, comes in, and Herzog with some other officers are doing the interrogation, and Herzog recognizes him. He was trying to use a fake name, and Herzog discovers that this is Heinrich Himmler. And it's just incredible to visualize a man who wrapped the Holocaust and a future president of Israel at that moment of discovery.
Quite incredible, yeah.
Of course, Himmler then went on to commit suicide in that same prisoner camp just within a few days.
But they were, you read about, in a way, I was thinking, reading a very good new biography of Himmler, but I'm much more interested, I can't get in, that they were such unbelievably, not only were they dreadful and murderous people, but they were terribly uninteresting people, as indeed Hitler was a remarkably banal figure. I'm much more interested. I want to read not more books about Himmler and Hitler. I never cease to be fascinated. It's the German people that are so fascinating. How nobody's yet come up with a good answer. How could it be that one of the most civilized and cultured and educated societies in Europe could have surrendered themselves?
Well, by now, with all the work you've done, you must have some purchase on that question.
Well, I've interviewed countless German officers who, again, part of this brilliant military caste in Germany, who all think of themselves as officers and gentlemen. You'd say, but the German army was the only force that could conceivably have dispossessed Hitler. and especially by 1943, 44, when it was plain that the war was being lost, then you could have saved the German people. You could have saved countless lives. If Hitler had been killed in the bomb plot, 2.5 million German soldiers' lives who died between July 44 and May 45 could have been saved. But all these Germans, even in their old age, they draw themselves up to say, we are officers of the German army. We have to respect our military oath. We have to respect our loyalty to the Führer and all the rest of it. And you looked at these men, because most of them are now dead, but when I saw them, we were much younger. There's this sort of gap. It's rather the same. I mean, again, 30 years ago, one was able to interview some of these dreadful war criminals. And I remember talking to a Nazi major who commanded Heinrich Wolff, who commanded a reconnaissance unit in France, the 2nd SS Panzer Division, on its way up to Normandy. And they'd stopped off in the town of Tulle in the Corrèze to deal with a bit of trouble with the resistance. And before they dashed on to Normandy, Wolff thought that they ought to discourage the French from doing this again. So he hanged 99 perfectly innocent people from the lampposts of Tulle to discourage the French from having any traffic with resistance again. And when one was talking to these sort of people, he was trying to work out a way to keep the dialogue going. And I remember saying to him, this conversation probably took place 30 years ago, I said, when you look back all these years after the war, does it still seem quite as good an idea as it did in June 1944 to hang 99 perfectly innocent people from the lamppost? And there's this old man, very upright in his lederhosen, sitting there in his rather nice little chalet in Bavaria. And he said, we let them have a priest. He said, when else did you hear of people being hanged in the war who were allowed to have a priest? And he said, in Russia, we did things like this every day. And even then, because I'm a boring old Anglo-Saxon who has trouble concealing my feelings, you feel you want to leap out and run out of the room and have nothing to do with these people. They inhabit a universe. They're supposedly on the same planet as us. But my God, it's sometimes difficult to...
Doing the sort of research you've done for this book and for all the other preceding works on World War II, and even for that matter, the adventure you had in the book you did about the Falklands War, because war is war, however miniature or however vast. Surely you've asked yourself and probably come to some at least tentative conclusion with response to two basic questions. How can people do such dreadful things in war, the Schrecklichkeit of the killers? And how can other people, the victims, endure against what is truly not a day in hell or a night in hell, but a long en saison d'enfer? It's a season in hell that goes on for 5 years.
I look back with some embarrassment to my childhood when I grew up, as many people in my sort of background, the middle classes in England. Mm-hmm. My father and his friends brought me up to believe that World War II had been a great adventure, a great romp, laid on for their own amusement. And I grew up, my father would say, well, when you grow up, of course you can do other things I've done, like become an army parachutist and ride the Cresta Run, Toboggan Run and so on. But he said, unfortunately, the Germans will no longer be available to play their usual 3/4 hour each way on the other side, as if this was all a great misfortune. And I used to read endless books about the war, which again just made it sound a great adventure. And then you start to grow up a bit, and I think my own growing up started when I was writing my first big book about the war, Bomber Command, and I was sitting in a suburban bungalow in Yorkshire talking to a man then in his middle age who'd been a navigator of a bomber whose pilot had won a posthumous Victoria Cross for staying with the aircraft after it was badly hit, so the others could jump. And this navigator said to me in 1977 or 78, I said, I'll always remember the night before that last trip, he said, we were all in the pub in York, and he said, we were all teasing the pilot, Jimmy, because he was 19 years old, and he admitted he'd never kissed a girl in his life. And I felt this terrible stab of feeling. I thought, what good does it do somebody to win a posthumous Victoria Cross if you're dead at 19, never having kissed a man in your life? Now, in this book, I've written a lot. I don't think I began to understand then, and perhaps you have to be getting to our age to understand these things, what the war was like for women. All right, a small number had a great time. A few of them did have a great time. But the vast majority, hundreds of millions of women all over the world, were victims of sexual exploitation on the most staggering scale because they lived in a world arbitrated by force. That there they were in normal times, that all right, there's crime, but generally speaking, that we are protected from violence. But here you were in a world where every day of your lives you were at the mercy of men with guns who could force women to submit. And this was something, this is not just the occasional rape that ends up in a court of law. This is something that's happening wholesale.
For the Russians coming into Berlin, it was a matter of policy, actually.
I mean, beyond unspeakable.
Yeah.
And what it was like to be a woman, to live through that era, and to see your children at the mercy of all manner of barbarians. It's something. I look back with horror at my own flippancy about the whole experience, and I think it's only now. I mean, I read a book, or in fact, the only review of my book that really upset me in Britain was a reviewer said, Max Hastings overdoes the horror. He said it wasn't that bad. Oh. He said my father was a submarine commander in the war, and he said it was the best time of his life. Well, I said, of course his father had a wonderful time if he was a submarine commander, but what if you were a Russian peasant or a Chinese comfort woman or something? It's so...
We have almost run out of time. I must put this last impossible question to you. Remember Pope Paul VI at the UN giving a speech there in French, and his message is jamais la guerre, jamais plus la guerre. Never war, never again war. Yet war continues. And we've had lots of war, and lots of war death, and lots of bestiality in war since 1945.
An optimist.
What's the perspective for?
I'm an optimist. I think one has to say, well, if you're going to belong to the human race, it seems to me we have to hope that things are a little better, and we have to say also, after the First World War, that a very successful British military correspondent called Colonel Repington wrote a book which was a bestseller entitled The First World War, and his title, when it was published in 1919, was thought deeply sinister because calling it The First World War presupposed another. Well, I wouldn't dare to call my book The Last World War, but I don't think it's reckless. Of course, we'll have more wars, but I don't think it's recklessly optimistic to believe that they may not be as unspeakably terrible as this war in which 27,000 people
died. Years ago, the British commander of the peacetime British Army of the Rhine, General Sir John Hackett, is that
his name? Oh, yes, I knew him well.
Wrote a book titled The Third World War, in which he imagined that coming upon us.
It is possible. I'm sure we're going to have plenty more conflicts and terrible things may happen. I don't think it's too optimistic to question whether we shall have another war in which 60 million people die. And I think the conflicts of the future will certainly be different from those of the past. And pray God, we have to believe they may be a little less terrible.
Unless they turn nuclear, which is the ultimate horror as we contemplate a complex future. But to understand the equally complex past, this new book by Max Hastings is the ultimate book that you want to get your hands on. Inferno, The World at War, 1939-1945. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, dear Milt.